Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My first guest believes that a sense of humor can be developed and enhanced. Jeannie Robertson is a former Miss North Carolina who went on to become an award-winning speaker. Her fellow Miss America contestants voted her Miss Congeniality. She was interviewed by CBS correspondent Morley Safer on 60 Minutes. She has spoken at the White House and has released six humor DVDs. In her career as a humorist, 6-foot-2-inch tall Jeannie Robertson has written three books: Humor, The Magic of Jeannie, Mayberry Humor Across the USA, and Don't Let the Funny Stuff Get Away. She has a fourth book coming out in the spring. Jeannie Robertson, welcome.
Hey, glad to be here.
I would imagine that sometimes you've been called a comedian, have you, rather than a humorist?
Well, I have, but I don't call myself a comedian or a motivational speaker. I'm a humorist in my mind. Would you like for me to tell you what I think is the difference between the two?
Yes, please.
The comedian's sole goal is to get most of the audience to laugh. And they can use any avenue that they want to. They can use off-color words. They can attack certain things. They can cause the audience, some people, to get upset and so forth. Although I think if you go to see a comedian, you should expect that. And I love to go hear comedians. But the humorist wants you to laugh just as much, just as hard, really sit there and just roar. But we want to weave a little message in there, just a little bit, a little point, even if the message is to look for the humor that's around you every day. The material that I started in the convention market, now I'm in the theater world, but in the convention market, the meeting planner's job was often on the line when their people came in and the speaker left with people coming up to the meeting planner saying, "Did you not hear her? Why did you bring her in? This is how, for, you know, she gave a testimony, and we're not of that religious faith. What are you talking about?" And so I want them to go up to the meeting planner and say, "Where did you find her? I needed to hear this." So the comedian also works mainly comedy clubs, and I started 54 years ago in the convention market. And then, because when I was in my 60s, Nancy, I embraced the Internet. I'm now doing theater shows around the country where people go buy several tickets and come to hear me do an hour and a half to 2 hours. Well, so the difference is the comedian just goes for the jugular at anybody's expense. The humorist maybe weaves a longer story, and I really want people to, I don't think I could tell a joke if I had to, but I would love for people to sit at home and say, "She's been a fly on the wall. Should the same thing happen to me?"
Yeah.
And, of course, it didn't, but it's so similar to things that happened to all of us, that's what they think.
My guest is Jeannie Robertson, and she is a humorist who is asked to give talks of conventions, you mentioned. But, you know, Jeannie, you just mentioned that you want people to go up to the planner afterwards and give him compliments. And when I was in college, I happened to be home from college one time, and I was telling my parents about this really funny student.
Oh, my gosh, you're going way back.
Oh, yeah, this is way back, because when we were both in college.
Were you in Quitman, Georgia?
I was, and this is where I was, and my dad said, "Well, you know," he said, would her humor appeal to my age group? And I said, "Oh, she would appeal to any age group." And so he said, "Well, I'm in charge of getting a speaker for our Valentine's Day Rotary Club when we invite our wives." So the day came, and you and I appeared, you know, we went to Quitman, and I could tell my dad was nervous as a cat. He barely said a word, because I know what was going through his mind was, "What was I thinking? I'm going to be so embarrassed in front of all my club members that I've invited this college girl to talk." And by the end, after your talk, he could not stop talking to you. He was so delighted. He just loved you. And everybody
was in the early 60s. I cannot believe, you know, when I saw that I looked you up on the Internet for the interview, of course, and did a little homework, and I saw that you went to Auburn at the same time. I thought, "That's interesting." And, you know, and I thought, and I have been to Quitman. I said, I spoke in Quitman. I told him, I've spoken in Quitman. No, you didn't. I said, I'm telling you, I've been there a long time ago. Nancy, I am sorry. I forgot it was you. Well, now, seeing people say, where do you get your material? I can't believe it. I do. It all just came back to me. But I did start at 19. You know, I entered, I was a rising junior at Auburn. I entered a pageant. I went home one weekend. My two sisters would have both said, are you kidding us? How embarrassing. And I had never been in anything like that. There were six of us. We almost drew for it. We'd all been to high school together. But I was the oldest one, and I became Miss Graham. And I went to the Miss North Carolina and then to the, as we say in the South, as you know, the Miss America pageant. And then that I was Miss North Carolina. I did not win the title of Miss America, but that year I had to drop out of school. Young women now already are out and have jobs and they take a sabbatical. But in that year, I got to make more than 500 little speeches, not 1.5 hour shows on the stage in a theater by myself, but five. And can you imagine being 19 and then I turned 20, having that kind of an opportunity? I just took it. It was like a duck to water. It took me a week to say things that were funny, and the people started laughing, and I just loved it. And so I crowned the next Miss North Carolina 12 months later, and the following week, I spoke at four conventions. And the word had spread that she can cut your ribbon, but can you give her 20 minutes? You know? So I know that pageants take a lot of criticism, and in some cases, I'm sure it's deserved. But in a lot, it's not, because for me, I just really grabbed that opportunity. It doesn't give you a career to be in a pageant, but it's like many things we do in our youth. It gives you the opportunity to develop some skills that you can use when you decide what you want to do.
Because a lot of people are funny, but they can't make a career on their sense of humor the way you have. And your path to being award-winning speaker is not the typical one.
No, it wasn't. All I was funny at first, but then I realized people always seemed to want me to come back, and so I had to completely change. I'm 74 now, and I've been doing this 54 years, and I'm busier now than I could possibly be. And I think if I were still telling stories about being a 6'2" contestant in the Miss America pageant, a basketball player, it would be like a one-trick pony. Yeah. She has this one little set of material, and she's used it and used it. But by looking for humor in everyday situations, because that's where you get your stories. And then I will say, albeit learning how to stretch a little bit and embellish and put the funny things at the end and set things up, that's all part of it. But the main thing is to keeping your eyes and ears open for the things that happen. But I just kept going every decade. So now I may tell a pageant story if I think it would work in a particular situation, but I'd much rather tell about my left-brain husband or all of my friends who I maintain, although they've become semi-famous through all the DVDs and the stories, I maintain everybody's got friends like that, that we just love. We look at each other sometime and laugh. And after my speech is one thing that is, and after the theater shows now, because that's where it's led to. But people come up to me and they will say the same thing people said years ago when I started thinking, wait a minute, I'm funny, but I know a lot of people who are funny but do not have a sense of humor. You let there be a problem, and they are upset, because people would come up to me and say, Jeannie, I wish I could stand on stage and do what you're doing, but I can't tell a joke. And I thought, well, I'm not telling any jokes. And then they would say, I wish I had a sense of humor like you have, but I can't tell a joke. And that's when I realized a sense of humor is an approach toward the way we live our lives. It has very little to do with being able to entertain people. Two different things. If you can get on stage or in a party, in a dinner party, always be the one with a very funny story with perfect timing, then that's what you have, a speaking timing ability. But the real question becomes for most of your listeners, do I have a sense of humor on a daily basis? when I work, can I have a sense of humor? With my teenagers, with things that just happen in life, can I keep a sense of humor? And that can be developed, and we can teach our young people how to have a sense of humor, just like we can tell them the fork goes on the left sometime, you know, south. So I begin to do the two. And now, at my age, people come up and say, you know what, Jeannie? I just can't believe you're just getting up there and telling stories of all these funny things that have happened to you, but we can say the same thing. And I've got family stories. I've got funny things that I can say and do. I just don't, and my point to all of those people is the same as I remind myself. We hear all the time, you can't take it with you. And they are talking about that statement really means monetary things, stuff, as they used to say, the stuff. But if we pass away and we haven't passed on our family stories, we take them with us. And I think people in my age and a little younger need to stop and think, where have I gotten these written down? Forget about your grammar having to be exactly perfect, the commas in place. Get the stories down or record the stories or get together and tell the stories. And we'll take them with us.
Well, your new book is a kind of departure, isn't it, for you, the one you're working on now?
Yes.
Is it family stories?
It's all about, it's a collection of the stories that some people have requested. The name of the book is Don't Bungee Jump Naked and Other Important Stuff. But if people have heard and kept up with every story or read every column I've written or blah, 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 on and on and on, then there has to be new things in there. And you do know that when you record or tape or film a story, you get better, and the story gets better. The recordings and the tapes never do. So more things. When I tape, I'll actually be taping my ninth DVD in March. We're all set up to go for another hour and a half of new stories that aren't on other. When I say new stories, I mean I've worked them and gotten them ready, but they're not taped anywhere. And so when we'll be taping that and getting all those new stories out there, And I hope I'll have them ready and that the people will laugh. And I just think looking for what is around us every day is the reason I can find more stories. I will guarantee you that when I started speaking, way back in Quitman, Georgia, I guess, because I think I went to Talladega and spoke for a friend's daddy, too. They were really looking for speakers. But I think if we go way back and keep the material fresh and you come in somewhere as a 74-year-old and you're telling stories about your husband, left brain, and all the funny things that happened to you at this age point, you can work and live in this and have a good career forever.
My guest is former Miss North Carolina, Jeannie Robertson. And we'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, former Miss North Carolina, Jeannie Robertson, who made a career as a humorist. Jeannie recently died, and we're listening to her interview from a couple of years ago.
Well, I wanted to go back to that point you made about being able to tell jokes. And I know a lot of people that they wouldn't want to stand up and do comedy, but they have such delightful sense of humor, and they make me laugh because they have such a wonderful sense of humor. And I think that's what you want people to realize, and when you've written this book.
Well, the stories in the next book, I take them another step further. Of course, you've got to include stories they haven't heard. So a lot of the new stories will be in there. And then the characters. I have developed, by accident, but then I have realized what was happening, a cast of characters. And now when I put out a new DVD, if I were to put out a new DVD and not have a story about my bestest, quote, incorrect word, of course, bestest friend, Norma Rose, people would say, is everything okay? Or if I didn't tell a story about Jane Tucker from New York City, who's tried to help me dress this 6'2" body, they would say, you don't work with Jane anymore? So they expect this. They've seen their faces, because when I tape the shows, everybody comes and sits in the audience, and they superimpose their name. And they're not made-up characters that you see sometime. People just insert in an old joke and say, Bob, I see you sitting out there, and this happened to him, and it didn't really happen to him. These things really happen. So I just believe what I was going to say with the new stories and the new books, we also are taking some of the stories further and wrapping it up with what's happened since then. Because I'll tell stories about Grandma Freddie in Auburn, Alabama, and people will say, was there really a Grandma Freddie? Did these things really happen? Yeah, you know, and you can illustrate a couple of other things that they do. So it would be a chance. The first book that I wrote were the steps to developing a sense of humor. The next book I wrote was titled Mayberry Humor Across the USA. I became so wrapped up in what I think is still the greatest television show ever produced, the Andy Griffith Show, that I thought there was a moral in every story. Plus, I just felt like it was everyday life. And studied it, typed in all the things, and I found a story everywhere in every state in the United States that I felt like tied in with an Andy Griffiths episode. I had a lot of time, Nancy, in hotel rooms to do these things. And then the third book, I developed a system on finding stories, because I'm past president of the National Speakers Association. I'm very close to professional speakers. I love the business, and a lot of people don't even realize that we exist, but of course we do. And I always say, when people have a choice, I'm tributary in here, I apologize, but when people have a choice, if you're putting a meeting together, then if you're having a choice, you can have a free speaker on one end over here. You can get a politician. You can get somebody who's campaigning for a certain bond to pass in town, somebody who's getting started. And if they don't have to be that good, but they come for free, and if you've got to have a rotary speaker every week, you can get somebody from the schools. And this is great. On the far other end, you have celebrities, and you pay big bucks for those people to come in. And their names get people excited, and the people just get so excited. They don't have to be a great speaker. They can be a John Gresham, a fantastic writer. Now, he may be a great speaker, because I've never heard him speak, but he doesn't have to be, or perhaps you get a professional athlete. But the people get excited, and they're willing for their group to pay this big fee. But in the middle, you have professional speakers. We do this for a living. If I say I'm a humorist, I darn well better be funny when I get there. You know, and you pay, and you do get paid to come for those. So, what I would like to do, to take you back to the book, is the next book will just continue my philosophy that I have looked and found all these stories, and I'm telling you, and I'm not a superb writer, and I'm just a person that looks at life through humorous eyes, and I listen to life with humorous ears.
Well, you do have to have a keen sense of being able to observe, because the rest of us see these things, and we don't see the humor in them, perhaps, that you do. So how do you sharpen your aware,
well,
your powers of observation?
Well, the second book was the third that I didn't tell you about, Don't Let the Funny Stuff Get Away. I developed this little system that works for me. And it's not going to work for everybody, Nancy, because they're not going to spend all the time that I do looking for humor. This is how I make my living. I'm lucky that it is also my hobby. But I have a little system that I fill out on every day, that every single person I encounter is a possible source of material. Now, let me make sure that you and your listeners understand, when I first started looking for stories, I was absolutely looking for speech material. I got started at 19. I wanted to, everybody loved it when I told a few jokes the first year and memorized. I had three jokes, old jokes. But when I talked about being a 6'2 contestant in the Miss America pageant, that's the ones they wanted to talk to you about later. The true things that happen. That's what got everybody excited. So I just take my everyday, and I have a sheet of paper now, of course, in the computer, that I would fill out. My day is first encounters could easily be with a cab driver. It could be with getting out of a hotel if I'm on the road, or if it's here, it could be the person who checks me in at the airline counter. And I try to initiate conversation, and I let the world write my material for me. The difference is that you just can't jot down notes. You have to go ahead and try to write it up on this sheet of paper in the old Reader's Digest paragraph form. And don't worry about perfecting it. Now, if you do this for 12 months and you're traveling, until I broke my knee, I was traveling 25 days of the month. So you, at the end of the year, I take December off. I have hundreds of little stories, and all you really need for the next year is another 15 or 20 really good stories that you can work on. But when I started looking for speech for my speech material, I remember the time exactly. I was in the Atlanta airport. All the flights were canceled because of horrible weather, and it had been that way, and it was going to be that way. And people were following flight attendants in the halls and pilots and fussing at them. And I was in my own gate area. I had pulled out a tablet. When I saw a group together and they were all traveling, I moved where they were. I eavesdropped. I'm looking for humor. And then all of a sudden it hit me. Everybody in my gate area was upset. But I wasn't. I was so busy looking for humor. And I begin to realize that that's the way to have a humorous lifestyle and say, this is the way. This is a way that we approach to living. And then the steps that I think, you have to laugh at yourself. And you have to look for humor in everyday situations, which I'm doing with my little journal. And we put it in a book because my assistant of 38 years, who was at Auburn when I was and wound up here with her family, and she's run my business. She came to me and said, Jeannie, everybody hears you have this secret journal system that you can find all these stories, and they want to know all about it. And I'm spending a whole lot of time telling about it. And so I said, let me just put it in a little thin little book here on how to do it and how it works for me and give examples of how, you know, of all these stories that I've found from just being out there every day. And, of course, they're not going to do it because I do it at single every day. But some people have said it really helped them. But the catch was everybody began to say, you can go to Toastmasters clubs and you can go to all the National Speakers Association chapters and you can explain this system. And I said, you missed the boat. I wrote it so I don't ever have to explain it again. Here it is. You know, if you can find it, if it really works, we'll all have more material than we will ever need. And another step, for example, is to influence others to develop a sense of humor, because when we make it a priority that to influence the people around us to have a sense of humor, we just really are working on our own sense of humor. Let me give you an example. We get very caught up with young children when we come home from school. I mean, they come home from school, and, of course, the questions are, did you turn in that spelling? You know, did you turn in that project? Did you have a pop test? What did you learn today? Are we going to do homework? Well, why not ask the question, tell me something funny that happened in school today? Then when it happens, now a young child's humor is different, and you have a lot of bad stuff. But when the banner peels off the wall, your child is then thinking, what do I get home and tell this? And take the same thing from a teacher. I taught 9 years while I spoke on the side and then realized something had to give. But a teacher, if something, say the banner falls off or the audio machine goes out or the computer goes completely kabunk and everything, the teacher's reaction is a teaching example right there. Because if the teacher gets upset, that And if the students start to laugh and the teacher gives a look that means don't laugh in this class, they stifle it, but they're still going to laugh. What if the teacher says, well, if that is not the funniest thing? You would think, how much tape is it going to take us to get this thing to stay on the wall? Who thinks they can get this thing? Do you see? We are, by influence, we are taking our children and saying that a sense of humor. And incidentally, I'm not a graduation speaker much, but once in a while I'm on the trustees of a university, Elon University. So once in a while you got to speak at graduation. And if I did a little research, I don't have the information in front of me, I'm not a researcher, but when the Fortune 500 CEOs were asked about what they want in a new hire, sense of humor rose to the top.
My guest is Jeannie Robertson, and she is telling us how we can cultivate a sense of humor. In fact, a friend once asked me a question, and I laughed, and he replied, good answer. All I had done was laugh, but he liked my answer to his question because I laughed. And I would think that also a source of humor is the fact that you are 6'2". And your husband is even taller than that. But I don't know if you remember this, Jeannie. You said you played basketball, and you and I were teammates. Do you remember?
Tell me, did I do well? Did you guard me?
Well, no. We were on the same team, and the intramural director put together a team, and we went to play another college because in those days—
No, I can tell you what we did. We went over and played Troy.
Yeah, Troy State University.
And do you remember, Nancy, that they thought they were going to beat us. And our coach had to go to a meeting, but we went on, in cars, and we had to put over our physical education uniforms, we had to put a piece of tape because Auburn, it was before Title IX. We could not do that. And I shouldn't have told the college, but here's what happened. We beat them. They were tough, and we beat them, and they were so angry and so upset, and they had two of the referees, that we went in the dressing room to change clothes, and they sent someone in and said, we want to play you again this afternoon. So about that time, our coach, the physical education instructor, came in, and she said, well, what do y'all want to do? And they said, well, we beat them the first time, and it was with their refs, and she was a qualified referee, and she said, well, let's play it again, but I'll ref. And, of course, she had our international law and all those kind of things, and we beat them worse. Do you remember playing them twice in one day? It was wonderful. I just loved it. But we didn't get to play. I had someone call me from the NCAA, a young person, one time, and they were to call and find out my fees, and did I speak to on. And the person said, did you go to college on a basketball scholarship? And I said, have you ever heard of Title IX?
Yeah.
I said, no, I didn't go. What was your major, Nancy?
Actually, French
biology?
And biology and French. I had a double major in French and biology. But it just showed that other team had no sense of humor, Jeannie.
No, they did not. They were very upset. Very upset. They came in on motorcycles, some of them, and we scared us to death. We had never seen that. And they were very good. But we had our act together, and I loved beating them twice.
Well, Jeannie, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to say goodbye for now, and I'll look forward to talking to you when your new book, Don't Bungee Jump Naked, comes out. But I'll remind listeners that you wrote three books, Humor, The Magic of Jeannie, Mayberry Humor Across the USA, and Don't Let the Funny Stuff Get Away. Such a pleasure. Thank you, Jeannie.
Thanks, Nancy.
After a break, I'll be talking to author Paul Harris, who was in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Californian Paul Harris wrote Diary from the Dome, Reflections on Fear and Privilege During Katrina.
Sunday morning was the mandatory evacuation by Mayor Nagin. 10 a.m., I was watching the Weather Channel. It came on. The second he issued the mandatory evacuation, I caught a cab to Amtrak Greyhound. It's a combined station. And the cabbie said, it looks like they're closed. And I said, no way. He let me out. And so I got out, and sure enough, they were closed. I later learned that with the storm coming on Monday morning, the airport, Greyhound, and Amtrak had all closed Saturday night. So many of us couldn't get out. I thought of hitchhiking, but then I knew the worst place to be was on the freeway with a hurricane coming. So I knew special needs people could go over to the Superdome. That's what I did. I was one of the first person inside.
Yeah, because when you went, this was a vacation. You're planning on staying, what, 10 days?
Right.
So you had your reservations. And in fact, the first hotel kicked you out and said, sorry, you have to go find someplace else. So you found another place and they said, well, sorry.
Correct.
You have to find another place. And so you then, since the Superdome was near the Greyhound terminal and the Amtrak terminal, you just walked over there.
Right.
And like you say, you were one of the 400 sounds like a lot of people, but it's nothing compared to how many people ended up there. So you were really one of the early ones to arrive there.
Yeah, I was there at noon on Sunday. That's when they were supposed to let people in. They didn't let people in until about 2 p.m. They did a thorough frisking of everybody. They had an amnesty barrel. They announced if you have any drugs, weapons, alcohol, please deposit it in there. And I used to be a probation officer, so we would in juvenile hall do thorough frisking, and it was almost that thorough. I had to show a prescription for my Motrin in there, open up my suitcase. So while I know some things did get through, it was not what the media made it out to.
Well, now you say they, you're talking about the National Guard.
The National Guard did a fantastic job of inspecting us. They were way overwhelmed with the number of people. I would say they were
understaffed.
Maybe 400 of them for 15,000 people the first night, and it grew up to maybe 20, 25,000 people after several days.
Well, I was impressed with the way one of the guardsmen handled the situation, that with that many people and so few of the National Guardsmen, there was no way they could really enforce the rules they would like to have. And so one of them, one of the rules was you weren't supposed to smoke in the building. Mm-hmm. And he was very tactful. And do you remember what he said?
Yeah.
I remember it. Yeah, go ahead.
At first, people, after the lights had gone out, we had a little generator power. People were going in the bathroom, smoking cigarettes. And he was telling people, you cannot do that. And then eventually he went in there and said, you know, there's people, medical patients here on respirators, and you're killing them by smoking inside this building.
He was saying that, I can't keep you from smoking. I can't stop you from smoking. But just consider the effect that you're having on these people who are in really bad condition, people who have asthma or because there were a lot of people there who had been taken there because they had bad health.
Right.
So you're in there with thousands of these people, and were there pets allowed in there?
There were not pets inside the Superdome, but a couple days later when they let us go out on the outside forum, people who had been evacuated from their homes, I would say I saw maybe 10 dogs and a few cats, a couple of birds, that kind of thing.
Well, I ask because the kind of emergencies that we have here in the North State are not hurricanes, but fire is has been a problem. And I always hope that, for example, older people, that maybe their little dog is their closest friend. And I'm always so touched when a shelter is able to let that little dog stay with the person. And I never heard what was the case at the Dome, whether they did allow people to take pets in with them or not. And so it wasn't really, they weren't an obvious.
No. I don't think they did, because I don't think FEMA even allowed, they've since changed their rules, for you to evacuate with your animal. Now you can. So it wasn't just till, it was later on when there were private citizens rescuing people off rooftops, bringing them to the Superdome, that they had their pets with them. But again, those were all outside.
So you also mentioned that they had meals, MREs, the military kinds of meals ready to eat. And that the first time you got in, everything was very orderly. In about 45 minutes, you had your meal, and you didn't know how to heat it up. mean, you didn't have matches with you.
Right.
So I was interested in, oh, there's a way to heat that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not being from a military family, I didn't know there was a woman behind me, and she's very sweet and showed me that you take this one pouch and you add a little bit of water to it and it automatically heats it up. You put your entrees, you know, whether it's roast beef, whatever, mashed potatoes on top of that, and it will heat it. I mean, it's enough that it'll burn you.
Oh.
And I thought that was fascinating. So then the locals who I had made friends with, I was showing them how to do it. So, mm-hmm. But everybody learned that. And there was about 10 different varieties of MREs. We were thankful for that. And I was thankful that my tax dollars were going to a very good cause.
Yeah. And even as a vegetarian, that surprised me that they had vegetarian MREs.
Yeah, they did. They had, I think, two varieties.
And what people were very considerate of you and would pass you their vegetarian meal.
Right.
Thought that was nice. So you get in the first meal line and you get there about 45 minutes. Everything's mm-hmm. nice and orderly. And the next meal line took longer because more and more people were pouring in. And there comes a point where you mention that you lost power. There was no power in the Superdome, but then the generators went on. So you lost electricity, the generators come on, but they don't have the power to air condition the building.
Right.
So there you are. And I don't know if people are familiar with the climate in New Orleans, but it can be very humid. So there you are in the humidity, in the heat. It's August mm-hmm. and no air conditioning and very little light actually either.
Mm-hmm. This was, August 29th, probably 90 to 95 degrees. 90% humidity, not to mention the filth, the stink. After a day and a half, the electricity was gone. The toilets were overflowing. There was no running water left in the building. So it was, best I can describe, is like living in an outhouse for a week. It was just horrific. People were wearing MRE bags on their feet because their shoes were ruined. People were sleeping on urine-soaked cardboard. The generator power was enough to give you maybe 40% light, and that was it. The first meal, 45 minutes or so. After that, it went from an hour and a half in line up to 3 hours by the time we got out. Some people were cutting in line, but the National Guard was doing the best they could to mm-hmm. stop that from happening.
You didn't tolerate that either.
No. I got really touchy when some people tried to cut in line. It almost erupted in a fight. But, I needed to stand my ground, and we all needed to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that having no running water would be the worst of it. I have been in situations and disasters where without electricity, that's okay. You can function. But when we didn't have water, and I thought about the family across the street has its huge house. This was at a holiday time when their house was full of visiting relatives. And I'm thinking, gosh, it's bad enough if you are by yourself without water. It's worse if your family members and you have no bathrooms that don't function. But here you are with thousands of people. And mm-hmm. I just can imagine that would be, I think, for me, the worst part of it all.
Yeah. We were very thankful that each packet of MREs had a handy wipe in it, so that was helpful. Uh-huh. Also napkins, and not to be crude, but those napkins served as our toilet paper mm-hmm. because they had run out of toilet paper after the first day.
Yeah. Well, if the conditions are so horrible, why didn't you just leave?
Okay. A lot of us wanted to do that. The National Guard said we could not leave. They said there was martial law in the city. You would either be arrested or shot if you tried to leave. And that was the rule. And they stood guard with their M16s mm-hmm. all around the perimeter outside the Superdome.
So you're really prisoners in there.
Yeah. And there was flooding outside the Superdome between 2 and 3 feet of water. But there were thousands of people who would have loved to have left, even wading mm-hmm. through the water.
I would think even after a while, he might decide, well, maybe being shot isn't so bad.
Exactly.
Maybe I'll take my chances. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. Well, as you say, you take walks around, because mm-hmm. I would imagine it gets pretty boring. I mean, hour after hour, wondering, mm-hmm. Well, is something going to happen? Are we going to get released? Are people going to come rescue us? And so you stroll around and you encounter a group of international group, people from mm-hmm. all over. What countries are represented in this group that you met up with?
Okay. Most of them were staying at the youth hostel in New Orleans. There were Australians, New Zealands, Canadians, Haitians, French, German, Spanish.
I think it was a
Taiwanese.
Danish.
A Danish guy approached me, and he could tell I looked like a tourist. And he said, "Do you want to join our group?" And I said, well, thank you, but I'm happy where I am with a couple of the locals. Also, I noticed most of their group was white. I didn't want to segregate. While I would guesstimate 15% of the population in the Superdome was white, I didn't want to make this little colony of white people. And so at first I said, no, I'm happy where I am. But I walked around a few more hours just to keep busy, get my exercise. I came back to my suitcase and I noticed something was gone from my suitcase, some like a brownie from my MRE. And so I thought the two guys who I was with had stolen it. And so I just said to them, hey, I ran into some people from California. I'm going to go join them in Section 113. It was all very cool. Days later, I discovered, though, that they hadn't taken a thing from me. But that saved me because I got to hook up with this group of about, had grown to 100 international visitors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you looked in your bag, you thought, oh, I put it in a different pocket
right.
than I thought I
exactly,
did. And,
exactly.
oh, I was having bad thoughts about these two guys
exactly.
and when they hadn't done a thing. But it did, like you say, that mistake on your part really is what saved you. And in the sense that when you did join up with this group, they were given special privileges that others won't. So why did this group get special treatment?
Okay. We spent Sunday, Monday, Tuesday night in the Superdome. On Wednesday, one of the Australians had been working with a sergeant in the National Guard and to arrange to try and get our group of 100 out. At first, I didn't know why we were given the special privileges. I thought maybe he really took a liking to some of the blonde Australian girls who were very cute, or he was scared for us, or what. Months later, I got in touch with him, and he said that he saw us as a naive group of tourists. He was concerned for our safety, and he liked our group, and he was driven by an angel to get us out.
Oh, yeah.
He was our guardian angel. And so they arranged groups of 10 of us at a time with armed guards to quietly get us out next door to
in
the
fact,
sports
they
arena.
They told you not to smile because that would give a clue because nobody else has anything to smile about.
Exactly.
And if they see this group of guys going out with a smile, they think, uh-oh,
yep.
what's going on
yep.
there? Because part of the problem was you didn't know anything. Nobody was giving you any information, so rumors are flying like crazy.
Exactly.
And that's all you had to go on. And you mentioned also, and it's in the subtitle of your book, Fear, because when the roof blew off of the Superdome, you didn't really know how safe were you in
right,
there?
Right. When there were two large panels, I would say 20 feet by 20 feet of the dome that blew off, water started to get in a little bit, but we knew that this dome was built to withstand 130 mile an hour winds at least. And if that happened, then what's going to stop it from all coming off, metal shards being sent down on our heads, decapitating us? Fear totally took over.
Mm-hmm.
We also heard rumors that another hurricane was coming in about 3 or 4 days. And I don't know why, but even though we were at that point way above sea level inside the higher levels of the dome, we pictured ourselves drowning. I mean, that is how powerful the fear was.
Mm-hmm.
And rumors were spreading. We believed all the rumors that you believed or heard on the media about the rapes and murders, even though they weren't happening.
Yeah. Well, I happen to have been an evacuee in a hurricane. And at the time, it was the most destructive, the biggest hurricane at that time. It's been since been surpassed. But we were told to evacuate. This happened in the coast of South Carolina. It was Hurricane Hugo. And as we were leaving, because there was only one direction to go, and that's inland, and our information was coming from the radio, and we would hear one announcer say, okay, we've been told we have to close down and evacuate. So we'd turn to another radio station, and then it would say, we've been told we have to shut down the station and leave. And so one by one, the radio stations were leaving. So we had no information either. One thing that I noticed that you did, you had the presence of mind to go to an ATM and get some cash. So you had some cash. And I think people don't realize that, well, just like right now, you can go get some gas. That's not a problem. You'll go to your ATM. But what about thousands of other people are all trying to do that at the same time? I think this is something that people don't take into account. And you mentioned toward the end of your book what you would suggest for a disaster kit. But there are also other things like that. I think if a hurricane is coming or fire or that to not wait until the last minute to fill your gas tank when everybody else is trying to do that or to go to the cash machine, the ATM machine, and get cash. So in some ways, you were in good shape Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of things that you didn't do. Your friends, you have nice friends who said, Paul, take this cell phone with you on your vacation. And you're packing. I can just see you packing your clothes saying, it's a vacation. I don't want people calling me. And so the cell phone gets left in California when you go to New Orleans.
Right.
Would you change that decision?
Most definitely. I was always anti-cell phone. I was one of the last ones to get one. And finally, my friends bought me one. And I looked at it. I charged it up. I left it in the room. And in fact, my friend Sarah, who was house sitting, called my cell phone and heard it go off in the other room. She's like, oh. So after the hurricane, I was able to borrow a cell phone. Only about 10% of them were working, I would guesstimate. And I paid a woman $10 to use her cell phone. I called back to San Diego and said I was alive and everything was okay. Mm-hmm. Everything wasn't okay, but I told them that. So yes, I would bring a cell phone. I would also, instead of just packing any family, don't just pack for 48 hours or 72 hours. I would do a week's worth of provisions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here in earthquake country, fire country, keep the provisions in your car trunk, plus your office, plus your house. And be prepared for the worst, or expect the best, but be prepared for the worst. Also bring, if you have children, things that occupy them, whether it's their favorite book, a furry animal, same for your pets.
Well, and speaking of book, that was another interesting thing I thought, that you almost took Thoreau's Walden with you. Almost did. And then you changed your mind on that too.
Yeah. I had started to read it finally after all these years because I never read in school and I loved it. And I loved Thoreau. Instead, I took George Lakoff's Don't Think of an Elephant, which is a political treatise.
But you know what, too, as much as I love Thoreau and would love to reread it, I think I would be so I don't think I would be relaxed enough to sit and calmly read in the circumstances that you describe. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, it seems like it would be very boring. Mm-hmm. But on the other, there are so many things to be fearful of. And that paranoia would overcome, I think, my desire to to read a book, no matter how much I like the book.
Yeah. I wasn't very relaxed, but I did bring actually a journal, paper, and pen to write with, but I just wasn't in the mood.
So it
was mainly walking around to keep occupied, keep my brain going. I played little jokes in my head, getting to talk to people, getting my exercise. I wasn't in a constant state of fear that I was going to die, but that was always in the back of my mind.
Well, I think one of the things that you and your group and others were wondering, why doesn't somebody come to get us out of here? Don't they know what's going on?
Yeah.
I'm sure there were all sorts of questions. And so you were complaining to each other, I'm sure, about the situation. What were the kind of things that you were wondering about?
Okay. We kept hearing the buses are coming. And it turned out to be a lie. The buses weren't coming. Then we heard about the flooding. We thought, okay, you know, we know these people are in desperate straits. We're at least in a safe, semi-safe place. But then an hour would go by and we hear more rumors. Nobody came through with their promises. And we really thought you out in America did not know we were even in there. All the communication we got was a couple of local radio stations where people were saying that people are stuck on rooftops. Please help me. I saw one reporter with a camera who was outside the Superdome. She was not allowed in. I saw one journalist inside. That was it. So we didn't have any information. Communication is so very, very important in any type of disaster, and it just really wasn't there.
In fact, somebody told me that the one radio station was really not a radio station. It was an amateur guy who had rigged his own way of communicating, and he was the one that was providing information. So, you know, you listed some heroes, people who really did things that were wonderful and some not so wonderful. But I think you should include the radio station on
yes.
that list of heroes.
Oh, absolutely.
And not,
yeah.
I'm, of course, not prejudiced or partial, but I think radio stations really. I know when the fires were raging through Northern California, people really relied on this station for information. So I would say the radio is one of the heroes. There was another hero, and that was a bus driver.
Yes.
When you finally did get on a bus?
Yes. I got in the dome on Sunday, finally got bussed out from the Hyatt Regency on Friday to Dallas. But about 50 miles outside of New Orleans, our bus driver came on the speaker and said, does anybody have any medical training? Da, 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 da. And he immediately did a U-turn off the next freeway exit, driving around cars. It was like a race car driver, and drove back to this bus that had overturned in front of us, and it was on fire. And he radioed again, anybody who has medical help, help me. And he ran off, pulled people out of the side of the bus that was on fire. Later found out that one person had died in the bus and about 17 injured. And that was just, we were so jazzed to finally be getting out of New Orleans, and this happened, and nobody spoke a word for hours. But yeah, that bus driver from Tennessee was a real hero.
Yeah.
I wrote to his company, but I don't know if he got it.
Yeah. Well, so he was another of the heroes. And then you mentioned that you were taken to, when you were smuggled out of the Superdome, first to a sports arena, and then to the Hyatt, this place that you had described as lavish when you were 21. That's where you got to stay. So the management of the Hyatt Regency is another hero.
Yeah, they did a great job. They were still open. They didn't kick their guests out, but they probably had several hundred guests who were in there during Katrina. They moved to the other side of the building when the winds hit and were actually throwing furniture through the walls.
The wind was.
The wind was, yeah. And they still had a receptionist in the lobby who would be answering questions. They did a great job as well.
So after this experience, what did you learn?
Okay. I learned to look at myself and see how fear controls my life in any type of aspect. I learned to be a little bit more critical of the media, to not simply accept something because it's on Google or in the media or you hear it. I learned to rely upon myself more and be prepared for anything. I learned that compassion goes a long way, helping one another. I learned that probably 95% of people have good intentions. And in this particular situation, it was laid out that a lot of the people were evil in the Superdome, but it was just a very small percentage. Most people in there were families with children who were in the same situation as everyone else.
Thank you so much, Paul. My guest has been Paul Harris. His book is Diary from the Dome, Reflections on Fear and Privilege During Katrina.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
I would also like to thank my first guest, former Miss North Carolina, Jeannie Robertson, who made a career as a humorist after the Miss America pageant.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.